just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
My generation. Take my generation, baby.
Welcome to Rockscope. Tonight we present A Conversation with Pete Townsend, the man most responsible for the lyrical and musical direction of one of the world's most popular groups, The Who. From their meager beginnings in a lower-class suburb of London known as Shepherd's Bush, Townsend and company have rocked, rolled, and smashed their way through two decades of diverse musical and social changes. The Who would have survived almost intact had it not been for the untimely death of drummer Keith Moon in 1978. Despite that tragedy and other difficulties over the years, Pete Townsend, both with The Who and as a solo recording artist, has carried on writing songs and making records that continue to prove popular with critics and audiences alike throughout the world. In this special program, British journalist Steve Turner will be speaking with Pete Townsend about the philosophy and beliefs which have inspired much of the music of The Who. Join us for A Conversation with Pete Townsend on Rockscope. Zoot Suit. The lyrics to this historic first single by the band are fairly descriptive of a style and image that was prevalent in the mid-60s with a large segment of British youth known as the Mods. Zoot Suit was written by the late Pete Meaden, who discovered the group now known as The Who in 1964. Fond of the image portrayed by the Mods, Meaden was quick to recognize the promotional value in shaping the visual image of The Who along the lines of their audiences, which were comprised mainly of mods during the band's formative years. Pete Townsend recalls.
When Pete came along with this mod idea, I liked it because it was to do with the street and to do with the kids that I'd been brought up with and went to school with. I could relate to it, it felt natural. And I've always thought of rock and roll as being something that was very much to do with ordinary people in ordinary situations, the new poetry, as it were, of expression.
How important was it to have a market that identified with you, i.e. the Mods?
In Britain, that is really important. I mean, even today, you see that in London, you see segmented markets for new bands, like the Bauhaus fashion of the moment, of the punk fashion that happened. In fact, there's even a mod, very exclusive number of groups who kind of have cornered the mod market as it is today. I don't think it's important for any other reason that any band that is beginning, that's starting off afresh, it's great for them to have their own little batch of fans who support them in their ups and downs. On the outside, the Mods just look a bit different. They've got a slightly cleaner cut look than is average. They wear their hair short and neat, and their clothes are slightly American influenced, although not as much as they were. I mean, suits and sports clothing in the summer, things like that. It's a very clean image, and that's really what it is. But I mean, obviously, like every other stream of subcultures, they stick together. That's the important thing.
Why should I care if I have to cut my hair? I got to move with the fashion or be outcast. I know I should fight, but my old man is really alright. And I'm still living at home, even though it won't last.
To most observers, the Mods were a social phenomenon, a subculture among the British youth. But to Pete Meaden, the man who discovered The Who, the Mods represented much more. He recalled.
There's Lao Tzu, there's Buddhism, Maoism, there's Christianity, there's Judaism, there's Hinduism. There's the Scientology guy, Lafayette Ron Hubbard. You can pick up on Process, the Process people. You can pick up on Charles Manson if you want to. I personally happen to pick up on the Mods.
I think there were a lot of mods that felt religious, because religion is a word for the trappings of spirituality, isn't it? It's a word that's become, in a sense, misused now. It means all the things around the individual's spiritual focus. And so in that sense, I suppose he was right. You know, a lot of mods do feel that what they do is like akin to a religion, but I don't think it's got a spiritual heart to it. It's just the trappings. It meant a hell of a lot to Pete Meaden. It meant a hell of a lot to me too, but I think it probably meant more to him than anybody else in the world. King Mod.
I don't mind other guys dancing with my girl. That's fine.
You're listening to Rockscope and a conversation with Pete Townsend. We'll continue in just a moment.
There are certain points in life when you go over big humps. I think one happens in late middle age. But I think possibly the most significant one that I've enjoyed so far is adolescence, and enjoyed observing. And I still find what happens to young kids as they grow into the world, or explode into the world, as it were, a far more evocative subject matter for music than the adjusting of somebody in late middle age to family life and 9 to 5 at the office. You know, it doesn't seem to have much to do with rock and roll. But I'm not adolescent anymore, so when I write a song about adolescent feelings, I'm obviously doing it far more as an observer than a participant.
Was a song like I Can't Explain, which is about being inarticulate, I mean, was that straight from you, or was that how you imagined it to be?
No, that was a song I wrote about somebody else. I wrote that about a friend of mine that I used to know from the Goldhawk, that kind of thing, who seemed to be like an incredibly intelligent man. And yet he just couldn't speak half the time. He used to write me these wonderful letters, and when he actually came up to me to speak, he just used to fall apart. And it was just an idea I got from looking at him and talking to him. No, I was always very articulate.
Anyway, anyhow, anywhere, that whole song is about sort of breaking down all restrictions and not being under any sort of authority.
Now there you see is a prime example of a song that I've written being completely misinterpreted, because it came through the Who mouthpiece rather than through my own. That song wasn't about that at all. That song was about spiritual freedom, and it was very self-consciously written. It's the earliest attempt that I had to actually write something of that nature. I was inspired to write it after listening to Charlie Parker play I had some records of his, and I'd listened to him for about 2 or 3 hours, and afterwards I thought, you know, here's this guy stuck in jazz, enmeshed in jazz, enmeshed in the heroin scene and enmeshed in the dismal New York jazz scene. It was terribly corrupt and terribly miserable from the outside, but within it he found a way of flying, and that's how he got the name Bird, you know, flying like a bird. He freed himself, and I felt that there was a spiritual freedom which he expressed in his playing, which is one of the reasons we think he's a genius. So genius is a word that you only use in a spiritual sense, and so I was trying to express that. I wasn't saying that I could do it or I could ever aspire to it even, but that, you know, it was about that. And of course, when the Who sang it, it came out like, oh, I can go anywhere, I can do anything. But really it was, you know, I can go anywhere, I can do anything the way I choose. You know, I'm free. It's about spiritual freedom.
I can go anywhere, way I choose.
My Generation has become a classic rock song now. and probably particularly because it sets the generations against each other, but that's something that seems an important part of rock music. And do you think it's a good thing that generations should be pitted against each other in that way?
Yes, because I think that if any generation wakes up to a position of growing up and saying that the world is perfect, then they've got it wrong, because the world is never perfect and never will be, just as long as it's full of human beings. And so every generation should claim the right to their opportunity to try and do it their way. And that is something which I think is just absolutely the way God planned it, and that's the way it should be, and the way it continues to be. And every time I see that mechanic happen, I find it refreshing. You know, I really found the punk explosion over here refreshing for that reason.
People try to put us to cut down my generation just because
I Hope I Die Before I Get Old is, is a very sort of rock culture statement, the fact of wanting to die while you're young. How have you changed your view about that?
Well, I haven't really. I mean, I've just taken it into my current philosophy or ethos, which is that in the end, what is age? What is, what is old age? Old age is the senility of giving up, in a sense, is the thing that we recognise as somebody that's given up and is ready to die and has abandoned all hope and lost themselves in a private world because they've either forgotten what life is all about or have just not interested in it anymore or confused by it. And for me now, I try to live the words in a spiritual sense. You know, I obviously can't stand up anymore and say that I wish I was dead in the way that I meant then, because what I was saying then wasn't I wish I was dead, but I hope I die before I get old and senile and out of it. Now that I'm 35 years old, I see it in a spiritual sense. I don't want to waste my life. I want every year to count, and I don't want to be either old before my time, and neither do I want to spend the rest of eternity going through the same things again and again and again and again, as you know, which maybe people listening don't, is that I believe in reincarnation and karma. That is a part of my spiritual philosophy. And that I feel that unless you actually face up to the fact that in the end you have to turn to God and turn to a spiritual way of living, you just spend your life eternally going through the same patterns again and again and again and again.
When did you change your thinking and become what you might term now spiritual? I mean, when did that process begin?
It was very sudden, but obviously it's inherent in an individual, I think, all the time. It's latent, it's there lying. And in my case, it was a feeling that was awakened by my coming into the compass of the work of Maya Barber. And at that particular time, which was like 1967, I think, just after the hippie flower power psychedelic era, I was very open for something like that. I was sort of starting to get a bit worried that, everybody that had long hair and flowery robes and had taken LSD and was talking about love all the time thought they really had it made, and yet it was quite obvious that nothing had changed and nothing would. And so I wasn't really duped by all that, although I was titillated by it for a little while.
Was acid an important experience in leading you in that direction?
In retrospect, no. I didn't have that many LSD trips. I think I had two or three. I didn't really totally enjoy any of them. There were odd moments when I felt I was having a good time, but most of the time I was, really concerned about what I was doing to myself because it was so powerful. I was very disturbed by it, and I think it did actually make me think. I thought things obviously aren't quite what they seem. But at the same time, I think the big thing that made me think about myself and what I was doing in the world was more to do with the fact that I had actually even taken this drug. I thought, what the hell am I doing? You know, I'm supposed to be an intelligent human being. You know, I should look inside myself rather than for external influences.
Pete Townsend's spiritual search brought him to an encounter with the Indian mystic Mare Baba. He'll be discussing this experience when Rock Scope continues.
After the brief disillusionment that I'd felt with the hippie thing, I decided practically to apply myself to the business of finding out who I was and, you know, whether I had any real spiritual potential or whatever, and came across a book by Mare Baba called The God Man, which was lent to me by a painter friend of mine, Mike McKinney, who did the Tommy cover and the paintings inside as well. Really haven't looked back since. You know, I've been very solidly locked into a spiritual relationship with that particular teacher, master, figure ever since.
I mean, was it something that you saw written, something that he'd said that convinced you?
I always get pinned down on this point. You know, what was the actual trigger? I can't remember. I've forgotten entirely. I've had a couple of very sensational events happen in my life since then, but nothing out of the ordinary. I think the main thing for me was the common sense that I felt that was written in this book.
Is there a discipline involved or anything akin to meditation?
There is the highest form of meditation known to man involved, and that is to try to live on a day-to-day basis, be a good human being, and all the time remember God.
How different is it from, you know, what we were told at school, there is a God, be good, don't hit people? I mean, how different is it from just the plain, what people might call common sense?
It's very different. Even though that is not to belittle the good value of that kind of advice to kids at school. But it's much more difficult than that because you're accepting God as a principle first and not last. You're getting things in an order, which I think is the right order. I have faith that Mare Baba is who he says he is. I have faith that he is Christ. In actual fact, I don't have any faith at all. I don't need faith. I have conviction. Absolute 100% total conviction that he is the God man, that he is the latest Messiah.
Wouldn't there be a sense in that you'd have to say that Jesus Christ failed in his mission if there had to be someone else to have a relationship with to get to God later on?
No, because I think that what happens in the world is that Christ's visits to this planet are constant.
Did you ever see the faces of the children? They get so excited. Waking up on Christmas morning hours before the winter sun's ignited. They believe in dreams and all they mean, including heaven's generosity. Peeping round the door.
Now, how has being a barber follower affected your music? I mean, how would you explain to someone or illustrate to them a way in which it had affected your music?
I suppose the first thing I'd point to would be Tommy, because that was the first thing that I'd written with a conscious spiritual slant. And then later on I'd point to other things, the fact that The Who have survived a lot of deep emotional problems and a lot of earthly dross, which a lot of other bands don't seem to have survived. And although we lost one of our members along the way, we are still together, we're still bonded together, and we still work together. I think I would point to the fact that a lot of fans of the group do feel a spiritual feeling at our concerts and listening to our music. People have written to me about feeling a spiritual wave, if you like, at certain points in Who concerts. And I'd point to the fact sometimes that unwittingly, like in the song Bargain, for example, I wrote about spiritual surrender without even realising that I was doing it.
Have you ever been tempted to write gospel songs for Mia Barber, as it were?
No, and I'll tell you why. What I'm afraid of is that I think that people that like The Who, and people that like, say, Pete Townsend's writing like that, they don't mind me being affected by a spiritual belief that I have, but they don't want to have it rammed down their throats if they're not interested, you know, and that's the way I feel too. I want them to judge me as a human being, and if they like what they see and they want to go a bit further into what makes me tick, then they might find interest in Mia Barber through that, and a lot of Who fans have. But as a rule, I try and keep away from that. I don't ever sit and say, I want to write a gospel-type song in praise of God and then hide it. You know, and I sort of say I'll write a song about a Cadillac instead, but really the Cadillac is God, because I think that's pretentious. But what I do sometimes unwittingly, like I said about the song Bargain, or listening to you, I get the music, without really realising I'm doing it, I write a prayer, and I think that's really the best way to do it, let it come spontaneously.
See me.
Listening to Rockscope and a conversation with Pete Townsend. We'll continue in just a moment.
How would you explain that Tommy was, in a sense, a spiritual story?
Well, just because I wrote it as an allegory of the spiritual journey. Tommy, I cast as a deaf, dumb, and blind individual in a normal world, because I felt that we are deaf, dumb, and blind to God, most of us. And you know, I use that as a kind of a device.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like him in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
What do you think gave Barber his authority that you accept?
It's something that happened in his life to him in the same way that it could have happened, or I believe did happen, to Christ in his life. It was something where he suddenly woke up and realised that there he was with a responsibility, that there he was with some knowledge, there he was with some persona, there he was with the knowledge of himself as God, God's messenger, and an incarnate messiahic character. And quite how that came about. I haven't got a clue and don't pretend to understand. It's just that I accept it because I feel it to be true. It's not something that I can intellectually guarantee to be fact.
Steve Turner speaks to Prabhu Guptara, an Indian writer and poet who is raised on the teachings of the Hindu scriptures.
Prabhu, you are a Hindu, you are a follower of Jesus. Could you explain to me what the difference is between the many gurus that we hear of here in the West that come from your country?
Well, the word guru is a very simple word. It means a teacher, a spiritual teacher. And the difference between Meher Baba and the other gurus is basically, in the Indian context, that Meher Baba is, shall we say, a rather eccentric guru. Theoretically, he accepts the authority of the Hindu scriptures, but in practice, he rejects them because he prefers to have faith focused on himself rather than on the traditional gods of the Indian pantheon. That's the principal difference.
If I'm a customer, as it were, of Eastern religions, what does Meher Baba offer me?
What he offers you is the same as what many other gurus working in the West have to offer you, a quick solution to your psychological and apparently spiritual problems, without any basis really in logic or reason. What they ask for is complete and blind faith from you, in answer to which, in response to which, they offer to sort out all your problems.
So why have you personally chosen to follow Jesus rather than one of the gurus from your own culture?
Well, you must remember that Jesus was, of course, an Eastern guru. He was not born in the West, he was born in Asia. So he's an Asian guru as well. But the reason I follow him is twofold. Firstly, from my own Hindu tradition, the Hindu scriptures lay down, if I remember correctly, 12 qualifications for a person to be a guru. And Jesus is, in fact, the only person who meets those 12 qualifications. But also, if you're speaking from the perspective of the ordinary man on the street, Jesus is the only guru whose claims are actually logically and reasonably examinable, if you like, investigable. You can actually look into them, investigate them, and see whether they stand up to the scrutiny of ordinary human intelligence, which is not a process that you can apply to other gurus. You either accept them on faith or you reject them. Jesus does not demand that sort of blind faith from you. He expects a reasonable faith from you.
I overwhelm as I approach you, make your lungs hold breath inside. Lovers break caresses for me, love enhanced when I've gone by.
Well, is it possible to be a follower, say, of Meher Baba and also be a follower of Jesus?
Not really, because from the Baba's perspective, of course, he makes exclusive claims. He claimed to be God, just as other people in his tradition claim to be God. And Jesus similarly claimed to be God. Now, unless you believe that God is in a very vague way present in all of us, and therefore also present in Meher Baba and Jesus and you and I, it's not really possible to follow both Meher Baba and Jesus, because one of them must be right and the other person must be wrong.
Why do you say that one must be right and one must be wrong? Can't they both be right?
Well, I would like to believe that they would both be right, because it would be very nice and very comfortable if they were both right. But in fact, it's very difficult to believe that, because they taught such completely different and contradictory things about themselves, about the nature of the world we live in, about what's right and wrong in personal conduct, about the way we should live, about everything, in fact. There's very little in common between them. You can't really say this is black and this is white at the same time.
I think, as you're probably aware, because I know you read the Bible too, a lot of Christians would have a problem in the sense that Christ said there will be many people coming in my name saying I'm the Christ, but don't follow them, they're false prophets. I mean, how do you understand that statement of Christ?
He said it again, folks. I just said it all again. Exactly the same thing.
But that's like saying he said, watch out for false Christ, and a guy comes along who's a false Christ and says, watch out for false Christ.
Well, you do have to watch out for false Christs. I mean, how do you judge a false Christ if you're not spiritually aware? You use your heart. I don't know. I think it's a tricky area, and it's not something that I'm really that familiar with debating, because like I said, my conviction is so strong, so I tend to dismiss debates on this subject. I won't be drawn into conversations with Christians about who's true or false, because I love Jesus and I respect Christians because I feel so close to them. But I understand that they can't accept, if they haven't been touched in the same way as I have by Mayor Barber, I understand that they would want to kind of debate the subject, but I refuse to be drawn most of the time.
O Pavadika, the preserver and protector of all, without beginning are you, Lord, without end. None jewel beyond compare, and none can measure you. Without colour, expression or form, nor attributes to lay.
You seem to be saying, when it comes down to religion, it's not so much the experience that you feel you get from it, but that we should judge all things by the criterion of truth. Is it true? Does it fit the world as we see it?
That's right. Because the experience that any religion has to offer you is rather like the experience that any other religion has to offer you. Because in all religions you will find some concept of God, some concept of faith, some concept of love and beauty and so on, prayer and personal satisfaction and all that. The essential elements of all religions are, at the experiential level, very similar. The question is, which of these is true? Which of these really fits the world as we see it? And the answer, the only answer that I've found after investigating all these gurus and religions and so on, is not religion, because Jesus didn't really come to set up a religion, but Jesus and his claims and his way seems to be the way that fits reality, fits the world as it is, as I can see it, and as any other reasonable human being can see it.
How would you explain what Barber stands for to somebody in order to interest them in becoming a follower of Barber? I've always been a bit mystified when I've read the writings, in the sense that I can't sort of get a grasp of what is actually being offered or said.
Well, I think the reason that would happen to you is that you're a Christian, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And you're already in love, in a sense, and enveloped in love, and enveloped in the love that is particular to the teachings and the life which Christ led on earth. So you don't need anything more. You've already been touched. And I think that what I would say to people is, look at Mayor Barber's work and photograph and see if you fall in love with him. And if you fall in love with him, then that's the work done.
You've been listening to Rockscope. Executive producer Mary Neely. A Conversation with Pete Townsend was written by Steve Turner and Mike Rowe and produced by Daryl Zachman and Mike Rowe for Songgrate Productions. Any comments should be directed to this radio station. For a free written transcript of this program, please send a stamped self-addressed envelope to Rockscope, 9844 Business Park Drive, Sacramento, California, zip 95827. That's Rockscope, 9844 Business Park Drive, Sacramento, California, 95827. Please be sure to include day, time, and station on which you heard this broadcast. I really wanna know.